We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
What's going on, everybody? Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio for April 18, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Great to be on the air here with everybody. I was alerted to our numbers shortly before going on the air. That's a nice little tune right there that just jumped in. We've got a lot of stuff to get into here today. I was alerted to our numbers right before we went on the air, and very happy to announce that I think this is the most people we've ever had listening at the beginning of the program. So hopefully it's because people are excited about the program tonight. We are going to be joined by Jay Spivak, and he has written a very interesting book. He is a former pilot. Captain J.P. Spivak is going to be on the show. And so obviously, you know, some of the things we are going to be talking about. Most notably, the Malaysian Airlines flight that has completely disappeared. And as of the time I am recording this show, as of the time we are going live here tonight, it has not been found. And so we are going to talk to a pilot about all of this. He's actually, the book is very, very interesting. He's written about his entire life as a pilot. He's got a lot of really great stories. The book is called Dangerous Lessons. You can find it on Amazon. Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an airline pilot's story. P.J. Spivak, the author, and I've tweeted out a link to the show, which you can check out. And as noted, he's got a lot of great stories about just life as a pilot. We're going to be talking to him a little bit about that. As always, whenever I have somebody in the airline industry on, I've got to ask them my own personal questions as someone who flies a fair amount, such as why. I guess it's not so much anymore, but in the old days, not only did your device have to be on airplane mode, but it had to be shut completely off and shut down. And it always drove me nuts. Why can't I read my iPad if it's on airplane mode? There's no signal being sent. So anyway, I got a lot of questions related to that as well. We're also going to talk a number of different interesting topics, including famous hijackings. We'll talk about D.B. Cooper with P.J. Spivak. We talk about the Malaysian flight that is still missing, Malaysian Airlines. In fact, there's a new article from CNN we'll talk about in just a moment about Flight 370. So it's going to be a very interesting show. I'm very excited to have him on. For the first 20 minutes or so, however, we are going to run down some news and take your open line phone calls as well if you've got anything on your mind. Now, a couple of quick notes before we get into the show. Obviously, the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. That is the main website for this program. As always, at the start of the show, I note that if you did not hear last week's show, you can go up to the website right now and download it. Larry Stone was on the show. He was talking his book, Noah, The Real Story. Had some serious phone connection issues. It is not the greatest interview in terms of audio quality, but I tried to fix it as we went along the best I could. And as it gets going, it does get a little bit better. But it is very interesting. Audio quality aside, very interesting interview. Larry Stone. That is up right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com if you did not hear it last week. Also up at the website, we've got all of the phone numbers, the emails, everything. The phone number, 855-478-4478. We've got the email address, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line. And we've also got news up there. Our Twitter feed, at Brian Alvarez, is the Twitter handle. We'll be using the hashtag DMRadioNet tonight as well, if you'd like to contact us. And we've already got people on the phone, so we're going to take some calls right now. Again, if you missed the numbers, head to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. To the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
It's Dave from Wisconsin.
Dave, what's up?
Earlier in the night, I was watching this program on H2. It's called, like, was it Hangar 1 UFO Files? And they briefly talked about how pilots have a stigma towards reporting UFO files. And I thought, since you're having this guy and as a guest, I was curious to see if that is true, that pilots aren't supposed to report UFO files with fear of, like, losing their job and being seen kind of as crazy. And a second question would be kind of a follow-up, if he has had any, and even if he had, would he talk about them? That's all I got.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. I will try to ask him about UFOs tonight. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. In reading his book, and I've read his book, it's a very good book, no mention of UFOs in the book. So if he did have any UFO encounters, he did not. He decided that maybe that is something that you don't want to write about in the book. But very forthcoming about a lot of different things. I mean, if you want to know, if you're interested at all in the airline industry, especially if you want to be a pilot, there's actually at the end of the book, he's got a list of suggestions what to do if you want to become a pilot. And it's actually, I bring it up because whether you want to be a pilot or not, it's a very fun book. And when you get to the end, you should read that advice and apply it to any job you are trying. If you're unemployed, if you're like a kid and you're just coming out of school and you're about to get your first major job, you really should read this chapter whether you want to be a pilot or not, because he's got some great advice about how to get and keep a job. It's actually an excellent chapter, so I would strongly recommend that. It's at the very end of the book. Let's talk about this Malaysian. What is the latest on Malaysian Airlines Flight 370? This from CNN. This was actually from about how did I get this from a week ago? This is not, hold on a second, everybody. This is not the absolute latest, because I thought this was the absolute latest, but it's actually from 1 week ago. So let's get the absolute latest news on this story. Here we go. This is from CBS News, the latest on Malaysian Flight 370. Let's try to make sure this...
Flight 370.
I knew that thing was going to come up. All right, we've got from Perth, Australia. Investigators are analyzing data collected by a robotic submarine that completed its first successful scan of the seabed on Thursday in the hunt for the missing Malaysian plane, but say tests have ruled out that a nearby oil slick came from the aircraft. How many oil slicks and debris, how much debris have we seen in the ocean that's turned out to not be from this airplane? My wife is she runs a nonprofit that deals with basically attempting to save the whales. And anyway, she's alerted me that there's a lot of junk in the ocean. So it's no surprise that they found oil slicks, they found debris. I mean, there's debris everywhere. Doesn't mean it's necessarily from this plane. And in fact, this slick here was not. The unmanned sub's first two missions were cut short by technical problems and deep water, but the Bluefin 21 finally managed to complete a full 16-hour scan of the silt-covered seabed far off Australia's west coast. The Search Coordination Center said, while data collected during the mission, which ended overnight, were still being analyzed, nothing of note had yet been discovered. The sub has now covered 35 square miles of seafloor. Separately, the center said the oil analysis done in the western city of Perth came up empty when the samples tested negative for aircraft oil or hydraulic fluid. The oil was collected earlier this week from a slick about 3.4 miles from the area where equipment picked up underwater sounds consistent with an aircraft black box, which at this point, as I'm sure everybody is well aware, would probably no longer be operating in the sense that it would no longer be transmitting a signal. My question for JP Spivak will be, how long is the data still useful? For example, let's say it stops, after 1 month, the battery dies, no longer sending up pings. But let's say that 6 months later, 8 months later, a year later, they find this black box. Will they still be able to extract information from the black box? We'll talk to him about that tonight. So the search still going on for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Do you think this airplane will ever be found? It's been 6 weeks now. Let's go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, Sam from Jersey.
Hey, get right into the phone because I can barely hear you.
Is that better?
That's a little better.
Listening to you talk about the Malaysian flight, the guest coming up later, I wanted to know if you could ask him about conspiracy theories on it. Like, when I first heard it, and even to this day, like, I still think that the plane is somewhere in the world, so to speak, like, still intact, not, like, in the ocean. And I think a lot of this stuff is a cover-up because they really have no idea what's going on. And I just wanted to know if you could ask him, like, what, you know, people, if there's any, like, conspiracy theories out there in that regard.
Well, let me ask you this question here. Let's say that they believe that it was diverted to wherever, North Africa. So would there not be a great deal of effort searching for it in North Africa as opposed to spending all of this time and money and effort searching in the middle of the ocean when supposedly they would know that it's not there?
I mean, yeah, it's a good point. I hear what you're saying, but if they have no idea, let's just say I'm right. I mean, I'm probably wrong when I say, you know, this worry, but is it, why hijack a plane just to crash it? Why do you need to hijack it to crash it, you know? It sounds like a very in-depth job, like, to just take a plane and crash into the ocean with the amount of intelligence they say that people had to have done this seems too silly for, you know, simple purposes of, we'll just crash the plane. That's my opinion. I don't know. Like, I really don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody really knows what's actually going on except the people who are on that plane.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. I got to say one thing about that, and that is that, let's say, as he had the alternate suggestion, let's say that it had not been hijacked and taken somewhere else. Let's just say that for whatever reason, they were going to just take this plane down to the ocean. My question remains, if that was the case, let's say that the captain just, like, flipped his lid and decided he's just going to end it all. Just go straight down, right? Why the diversion? Why the flying for 7 hours? Why all of that? I don't know. And obviously, at this point, no one knows. But that's the part of it that I really wonder about. If, for example, the pilot just decided to end it all, I mean, he went to a lot of trouble to end it all. Evading radar and this and that, just go straight down into the water. I mean, they were over the water. Why not just go straight down if that's your intention to just do some sort of, just commit suicide, I guess. If that's, and of all the ways to commit suicide, to take a entire airplane full of people with you, just it's a very fascinating story. I've not been following a lot of, I know for like a month, it seemed that the only thing on CNN was the story of this airplane. I presume they've somewhat moved on at this point. I don't know for sure. If anybody is listening, you can tweet me at Brian Alvarez and let me know. You can also use the hashtag DMRadioNet and let me know. Let me know if they're still doing like 24/7 coverage of this missing plane. It actually got to the point where there's a lot of stuff going on in the world. But you wouldn't have known from watching CNN since everything in the world was about this airplane. I did find that a little bit strange. But we'll talk more about this airplane here in a couple of minutes when we have PJ Spivak on the show, author of Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an airline pilot's story. Another interesting story that I was reading about all day today. I want to get into this here very quickly. This is up at unexplained-mysteries.com. And if you forget that, go to afterdarkradioshow.com because it's linked up on the left-hand side of the page. The story, did Monroe plan to reveal JFK UFO visit? Monroe who? Well, Marilyn Monroe. Again, from unexplained-mysteries.com, new evidence seems to support the authenticity of a particularly controversial declassified CIA document. Originally leaked in 1992 before being made public in 1994, the document allegedly contains wiretaps of Marilyn Monroe and her friends recorded just prior to her death in 1962. The transcripts concern the claim that Monroe had been planning to hold a press conference to reveal that President John F. Kennedy had told her about a visit to an airbase facility where he had witnessed debris recovered from a UFO crash. The document mentions that Monroe, and this is a quote from the document, had secrets to tell, no doubt arising from her trysts with the president and the attorney general, that being Robert Kennedy, and that one such secret mentions the visit by the president at a secret air base for the purpose of inspecting things from outer space. It also alleges that Monroe had become frustrated by the president as she felt she was being ignored and as a result threatened to tell all in a press conference. While the authenticity of the document has long remained controversial, a recent analysis has shown that it seems to conform very closely to a standard classified information report form that was used by the CIA in 1963. So did JFK really see a crashed UFO? Did Monroe really plan to hold a press conference to reveal this to the public? And did someone take the ultimate step to ensure that this did not happen? We may never know for sure. It says what it is not really mentioning here in this brief article here is that this claim that she had stuff to say and she was considering calling a press conference to tell all. This alleged conversation happened, I believe, 2 days before her death. And so the theory is that they came and they made sure by killing her, let's not dance around the topic here, that she did not get this information out to the world. Do you believe this? Now, the one thing about this that I find very interesting is it doesn't say in this brief excerpt from the document that JFK was investigating aliens or alien craft or alien bodies. All it says, and this is a direct quote, that one such secret mentions the visit by the president at a secret air base for the purpose of inspecting things from outer space. Now, why would it be a secret that he visited a secret air base to examine, say, a meteorite or something that had fallen to Earth from outer space, something perfectly natural? It does seem strange that this would have to be a secret visit, but it could have been something of that nature. It could have been something natural that they had something fell to the earth, portions of a meteor, who knows? That could have been what he was inspecting. Could have been something perfectly innocent, despite the fact that one would think it would not have to be a secret visit. But this excerpt here says nothing about UFOs or aliens. So perhaps it is a legitimate document from 1962. Or 1963, but not actually talking about anything truly extraterrestrial, at least in the sense of extraterrestrial life. I guess anything meteorite would in fact be extraterrestrial. But you can check this out if you Google Marilyn Monroe JFK UFOs. I'm sure you will find significantly more, because I did today. I was reading all about this today. It was fascinating. I will say that. I will say that the analysis, I saw a side-by-side analysis of this supposed document with another CIA document, and they really did appear to match up. So we will not know for sure. But I just was sent this on Twitter, actually. Rav here says that CNN has moved on to bigger breaking news. And the breaking news, and he has included a screen cap, which makes this even funnier. I guess it shouldn't be that funny. It is about a tragedy, but the breaking news is that the Titanic sunk 102 years ago tonight. I'm actually going to retweet this to everybody. It's so preposterous. If you head up there to @BrianAlvarez, you can check out this screen cap of this breaking news. The Titanic sinking 102 years ago. We will continue on later on this evening with news stories, but I don't want to waste any more time. Let's go to this interview. I got a lot of stuff to talk about. I got to ask about DB Cooper. I got a lot of questions about this Malaysian Airlines flight that has vanished. And I want to talk to him about his book. It's very interesting. Just talk to him about the life of a pilot. Have you ever flown in a plane and you're sitting next to that person and they're just white knuckled, they're sweating, maybe they've taken some Dramamine. This flight is just, it's shaken them to the core. Has that ever happened to you? I have flown enough that I no longer fear flying, because I've come to the conclusion that the chances of an airplane going down with me in it, sure, it can happen, but it's probably, knock on wood, probably pretty unlikely. Is that the case? We're going to ask Captain PJ Spivak about that and a lot of other topics as well. It's going to be a very fun time, so stick around, everybody. Back in just a moment with Jay Spivak talking the life of an airline pilot, DB Cooper, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, and more here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Back here on the show, After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. Very happy to be joined today by Jay Spivak, or perhaps PJ Spivak. He is the author of Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an Airline Pilot Story, which is available on Amazon.com. The paperback version, $12. But if you've got a Kindle, $4.99, you can check this book out. Very interesting book. And would it be Captain Spivak, PJ, Jay? How would you like to be addressed?
Oh, PJ is good.
PJ is good.
That's right.
I do a lot of, we were talking about this before we went on the air, I do a lot of flying. And right. So I read your book, and It was very interesting because I fly with people sometimes that don't do a lot of flying.
Yeah.
And they don't like getting on airplanes.
Yeah.
And I always say to them, listen, you got to think about how many airplanes take off and land every single day all over the world.
Right.
And obviously, we had Malaysian Airlines 370, which we'll talk about here in a while. Hmm. But it's not like something like that is happening every day. Your chances of crashing are very slim.
Right.
So then I read your book, and you know, you're here talking to me, so you weren't involved in a catastrophic air crash.
No, because I'm here.
Yeah, but in reading your book, there were a lot of scary things that happened, and the you know, Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, just, you know, the title itself should tell you,
right?
You know, some crazy things happened to you. I guess we'll start off here just by telling everybody that your first airline experience, I believe, was witnessing an airline crash.
That's right.
And you still got into this business. Tell us about this.
Well, I was lying in bed one morning. It was a Saturday morning. I was 12 years old and was back in New York, where I was born and I grew up for part of my life. And all of a sudden, while just lying in bed, I heard what sounded like an airplane about to fly through the window of my room. And a moment later, I heard a huge explosion, which unmistakably was this airplane crashing. And I could tell that it was a big transport category airplane. So I put clothes on and ran in the direction of the sound. I saw a big billow of black and gray smoke. And it was only a couple of blocks away from where I lived, and I arrived at the site of the crash, and right before the fire engines arrived, there was a couple of houses on fire, and it was the first time I've ever been in the vicinity of a large airplane. And of course, this airplane was, reduced to just little pieces and bits and, just parts of the airplane. And I was just in awe of what I was seeing. This was a cargo airplane. It was an old C-46, a Curtiss Commando, weighed about 50,000 pounds at takeoff weight. And it was twin engine, two crew on board. And the first thing I saw was this big, giant radial engine sitting on top of a car, which happened to have as its occupant a police inspector in civilian clothes. The radial engine was sitting on top of the car. The car was crashed, was smashed, rather, by the engine. And this poor police inspector, was lifeless. He was dead. And when I looked at him, I just never had seen anything like that in my life, because this was back in 1952, and you just in those days didn't see very many horrible things on in the newspapers or magazines, like you do today. So I was just stunned. I was just knocked right back on my heels. And anyway, I walked around a little bit, and I saw what was actually the remains of the cockpit. There was a couple of control wheels and instruments on a panel and some seats. And while I was walking around the cockpit, I saw this glove, this black leather glove, and I don't know what made me think it, but I just said, I bet that was one of the pilot's gloves. And I moved a little closer, I inched a little bit closer, and as I looked closer to the glove and followed towards where the arm would and the hand would be inserted in the glove, I saw the remains of half of a pilot. And it was just so shocking and devastating that it's something I'll never forget. I occasionally have a dream of it, and it was my first experience with aviation, and it awakened me to aviation. I know I thought had lots of questions about what made that airplane crash and so forth, but it certainly frightened me a bit about aviation, and that was my first experience.
Now that was 1961.
No, it was actually I was 12, so that would have been 1952.
52, okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember you talked about how years later you went and actually Googled it and you found the article.
When I was writing the book,
yeah.
I Googled it, and I saw it. There it was, cargo plane crashes in Jamaica, New York, and the hair on the back of my neck just stood up, because I never expected that I would see a newspaper article from back in the 50s. But what startled me, Brian, even more was to realize then that C-46, the model airplane, the C-46 model airplane, was the first airliner that I actually flew.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know it when I flew that airliner. It was only, 35 years or 40 years later that I discovered the first airplane I flew as a pilot was the airplane that nearly killed me and my family in Jamaica, New York.
Now the airline crash, if you read the book, I mean, it's not like you saw this crash and thought, I want to be a pilot.
Oh,
the impression
absolutely.
I got is, nope, you didn't want to be a pilot, but circumstances occurred and eventually you got into it. And that brings me to the next question. I had a friend growing up, and his mom, she decided she was going to be a stewardess.
Oh.
And on her very first flight, they had some terrible turbulence. I think they may have had to do like a turnaround or something like that.
Yeah.
But suffice to say, that was the end of her career. I mean, she was just like one and she was done. And that was not the case with you. You had many experiences where, a lot of people would be like, that's it. And you even write in your book, I don't even know what even possessed me to, keep doing this, but you did.
Right. Yeah.
Tell us about your first, I guess, the first experience where a normal person might have said, I'm done with this.
Okay. Well, my first experience where I nearly said that I will never continue flying was when I took my first flight lesson. And it was in Sembach, Germany, at the Sembach Air Base Aero Club. I was in the military, and I joined this aero club at Simbach, Germany, and I took my first lesson in a Piper J3 Cub, and this is an airplane with fabric wings and lots of wires that would be rattling in flight, and not a very substantial airplane by any standards. So in my first, during my first flight, the pilot by the name of Harry Stacy, a great guy, took off, and we started flying over the countryside in Germany. It was very pretty, very green and lush, and it was a real awakening about how beautiful flight was. And within a few minutes, it started to get very turbulent, and I turned around. The pilot was behind me, the instructor was behind me, and I said, "You know, I think I've had enough. I'd like to go down. I'd like to land." And Harry had the foresight, and he was a wonderful instructor, and he said, "Well," he said, "PJ," he said, "you paid for an hour, and I like to fly." So he said, "Nothing doing." He said, "You have about 55 more minutes." And at the end of the 55 minutes, when we landed, I sort of rethought everything and realized that, you know, it's not necessarily that dangerous. And I kind of liked it, so I continued.
Now, you had an experience with, I believe his name was Captain Wolf, is that correct?
Yes.
Captain Wolf.
And that actually, I'll have to admit, was the name I used for him. Whenever there was something pejorative to say, I tended to change the name of the person. But
sure.
People who knew him know exactly who I'm talking about.
So there was this Captain Wolf, and it's interesting when you tell the story, because I'll let you tell the story here, but just the general gist of it is something happened.
Yes.
And it made you extremely uncomfortable, and you were very unhappy about it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it was something that you were thankful for in the end. As you note in your book, it was a dangerous lesson, but it was a valuable lesson. What happened with Captain Wolf?
Yeah, there's I'll tell you the story, and there's a really deep meaning to this story that could apply to a lot of people. Not only pilots, but in any case, in this particular case, it was during my upgrading to captain from co-pilot. And during the upgrading training, which is called the line checking, where I sit in the left seat, the captain seat, and the check pilot's in the right seat, the co-pilot seat, and he is watching me, and he's ready to take over anytime. Well, we had a plane full of passengers. We had, that was a DC-8. We had a stretch DC-8, in fact, a 63. We had 250 passengers, and we had a crew of 12. And we were supposed to land in Gander, Newfoundland, to refuel on the way to Europe. We had taken off from Ohio, from Cincinnati, and we had lots of passengers, lots of baggage, so we needed to make a fuel stop because we were going all the way to Italy, and there was a very, very, very little tailwind in that particular flight. So we needed to make the fuel stop. Anyway, as we approached, we were about 100 miles from Gander, Newfoundland, and I instructed the flight engineer to check the weather, and he told me, "Well, really bad situation. We're below minimums. The ceiling and the visibility is below the landing minimums." So he sort of dropped that little bombshell on me, and I said, "Well, you know, Captain Wolf, we're going to have to divert, and I've just checked the weather. I have the weather forecast here for I'm trying to remember the name of that airport now. It was it was another airport in about 100 miles from, St. John's. It was in St. John's, Newfoundland. So I said, "We're going to need to land to land in St. John's, the alternate." And Wolf said, "No, I'm sorry." He said, "We're going to land at Gander." And I said, "Well, we can't." And he said, "Well, we're going to continue and see how the weather is at the outer marker, which is the final approach fix." So we continued on. we got right outside the outer marker. I checked the weather again, had the engineer check the weather, and it was still below minimums. And I said, well, I'm going to do a missed approach. And he put his hands over mine, and he said, no, no way, we're going to land. Well, anyway, we continued down, and I said, at 200 feet, at our minimums, we're going to have to do a missed approach. And he said, no. He said, I'll tell you what, at 200 feet, you could just keep flying. At 50 feet, when I call 50 feet radio altimeter, he said, you raise the nose one needle width, 1 degree. And he said, hold what you have then. And if you're lined up with the ILS and the glide slope, he said, you'll make a touchdown. That will be acceptable. And everything will be fine. I said, well, that's completely illegal. And we have passengers on board, and it's dangerous. And he said, that's what we're going to do. So anyway, we did it. At 50 feet, he called 50 feet radio altimeter, and I raised the nose 1 degree. I flew a very good ILS, you know, and I had to. There wasn't any doubt that I had to. We hit the runway kind of on the hard side, and when we touched down, there was just nothing to be seen. You couldn't see the runway lights. You didn't see even the centerline light, which is hard to believe, but it was thick fog. And the nose gear, when the nose gear touched down, I just did maximum braking, maximum thrust reverse, and at 60 knots took the engines out of reverse and stopped. We couldn't see a thing. It took about 20 minutes for the follow me truck to find us, and they led us back to the terminal. I was not a happy camper about it, and I thought that this was an unnecessary risk to passengers. I mean, it could have not turned out well, and it could have resulted in a crash. Wolf felt that, I'm sure he felt that he would be able to take over in any case, and I mean, it was as non-standard, as illegal as could be. But in any case, it's what happened. I was, as they say, very upset about it, but that experience saved my life, and it saved and another airplane 30 years later, when I got sort of maneuvered into a situation where there was nowhere to go but to land. And had I not had that experience with Wolf, I probably wouldn't have survived that real experience that happened 30 years down the road. So the end result and the moral of the story, so to speak, and the meaning is that in life, sometimes we're required to do something that we really are opposed to and we really don't think is the right thing to do. But I guess the moral is that you never know when an experience such as that, you know, doing the best job you can do and getting through it and not complaining about it, an experience like that somewhere down the road can save your bacon, and it sure did me. So
now you told some other stories in the book about experiences that were not fun, and you know, everybody has to keep calm.
Yeah.
But you can look over and you can see that the guy with you is white as a sheet.
Yeah.
Now when this incident happened with Wolf, I mean, was he just cool as a cucumber, or could you tell that, okay, he's teaching me a lesson, but he's half scared to death here?
Yeah, no, Wolf was very calm, and you know, he was a very good pilot, and he was a person that that had a much stronger ego and a much greater opinion of himself than I had, especially at that time. And he was very confident in himself, and I don't think he had any doubts about the outcome. But, you know, on the other hand, sometimes people are overconfident, and they can sometimes wind up exceeding their ability. So
yeah.
I think there's a happy medium that you have to strike, you know, to be safe. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Now I'm 38, and so I can remember. I mean, to me, a big switch over when it comes to going to the airport was after 9/11.
Right.
You know, the security after 9/11 is compared to before 9/11 was dramatic.
Right.
And now you flew for many decades, and I guess how is airline safety and just kind of everything about the industry today as compared to the 60s and 70s? I mean, is it like a completely different industry? I mean, a lot of the stories you were telling in the book were kind of like, man, this would never fly today, but it flew then, so to speak.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, remember, you know, Brian, the airlines that I was speaking about and writing about in my book were the scheduled, you know, the charter airlines. And, of course, it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, 90s. And, well, in the very beginning in the 60s and the 70s, the navigation equipment was nowhere near the standards of the navigation accuracy that they are today. You know, in the 60s, we did NDB approaches and ADF approaches. And in the 70s, it was ILS approaches, and now it's very high-quality equipment, ILS equipment, and now they're even developing microwave ILSs that are going to be even more accurate. And then they have GPS approaches today that are extremely accurate, and they can back up your ILS approach so you know exactly, you know, what your situational awareness is, where you are in the approach by looking at your GPS charts and maps. You know, I'm talking about the electronic maps on your pilot flight displays. So, I mean, the equipment is much better than it was then. The engines are, particularly the jet engines, are so perfected today that engine shutdowns and engine failures are very, very rare, especially when you compare it to the reciprocating engines, the old radial engines. And the early jet engines, I mean, they had lots of problems. And, you know, since all this development, there's also been so much learned in terms of crew coordination, CRM management. Regulations have tightened up and for the most part have made things a lot safer.
Mm-hmm. Now, given how much technology there is today, mm-hmm. How good a, this kind of probably sounds like a weird question, how good a pilot do you have to be today as compared to in the 60s?
Well, you know, that's a really great question. And to answer that, I'd like to say that to begin with, I've been a flight instructor since the 60s, and I still maintain my credentials as a flight instructor, both in primary instruction, instrument instruction, multi-engine instruction, and even seaplane instruction. That's so, and also I became a Czech airman, an FAA Czech designated Czech airman in the DC-10 jumbo jet for several airlines. I was their training Czech airman, and I have really looked at and compared pilots today with pilots back then, and you know, in years past, pilots had to have very, very good stick and rudder skills. And today, the modern airplanes, the fly-by-wire airplanes, and in particular airplanes like the A320, the Airbus A320, those airplanes do not require a pilot with really great stick and rudder skills because they're so automatic. The A320, for example, I trained on that. You could slam the side stick controller full left, and the airplane doesn't respond the way you've moved the control stick. It responds at a certain given rate of response that an engineer somewhere in the software design has decided that the airplane will only turn at so many bank at so many degrees per second. And so as a result, I mean, you don't have to be a very smooth pilot to fly that airplane very smoothly. So what it all means is sometimes, I think today, there are pilots with less experience coming into the cockpit and becoming a captain of a large airliner. And I'm for example, I know many pilots that have never done, airline pilots that have never spun an airplane, you know, done a spin or done a loop. And it's not that you would do those maneuvers in an airline airplane, but you would do them. First, you'd demonstrate a spin in your commercial pilot training. And today, I mean, in the old days, and today it's not required by the FAA. In fact, it's even discouraged. The FAA inspectors won't give a check ride when a spin is being done. They ask you to sign a statement that says you've demonstrated at one point in your training that you were able to recover from a spin. They won't actually test you in this bin. Now, I'm not saying, I'm not criticizing the FAA for that, but I'm just saying the whole thing has changed that much today, so that I fear that there are some pilots that get to the cockpit, you know, without the background. And one particular accident that happened, I think it was 2 years ago, where a small commuter plane in the U.S. had entered a stall, and the pilot attempted the recovery, but instead of reducing the attitude of the airplane, lowering the nose to recover from the spin, he actually did the opposite. He pulled back and exacerbated the spin, and the airplane crashed. And it had a number of passengers on board, and that was a commercial flight. So I don't think that probably would have happened in the old days, because I think the pilots would have been practicing plenty of stalls and plenty of spin recoveries, and they would have known just what to do. But this pilot apparently didn't have the experience. So I think that kind of addresses your question.
It's funny you should mention the Airbus A320, because I was going to ask about the crash from January 2009. I guess crash is the wrong term. It was a what would you call it? A controlled landing, or was it a crash? When the birds hit it.
Oh! Are you talking about
the Miracle on the Hudson?
Miracle on the Hudson. And that's a great example. What a terrific incident to talk about. You know, an absolute tribute to to a great pilot, Chesney Sullenberger, for having the ability to execute a complete dead stick engine out. Both engines were out. Engine out landing on the Hudson River. Obviously totally unplanned, spur of the moment. The captain had made some incredible instantaneous decisions as to where he would likely have the best outcome of the landing. Did an incredible job. Yeah, that was an instance where geese had been ingested in both engines, first one and then the other. And a lot of people don't realize it, but engines are tested to continue to function, and I believe the Airbus is tested with a 5-pound bird. Up to a 5-pound bird could be ingested, and the airplane would continue. The engine would continue to run, but these geese were large. Apparently, they were in the 15 to 25-pound range, and enough of them were ingested in each engine that both engines failed. You know, the geese hit the inlet vanes, guide vanes in the front of the engine, and then they began to shatter, and get those metal titanium blades got ingested in the remaining of the engine, just chewed the engine completely up until it just stopped working. Well, Chesley Sullenberger just made a quick calculation. He thought at first maybe he could reach Newark Airport, which was just to the southwest of LaGuardia, and realized instantly that he couldn't. He was losing altitude too fast. So he looked around, he saw the Hudson River, and said, well, I'm going to have to put it down in the Hudson. So this particular captain had a lot of experience in flying acrobatic airplanes. He had flown a lot of smaller airplanes. He had, non-commercial aviation. He just was an all-around great pilot, and he judged his distance to the touchdown point on the water perfectly. He his attitude was perfect upon touchdown, and there was a little bit of luck involved, that one wing did not dip. He kept the wings perfectly level. I'm sure that it was mostly skill. There's always a little bit of luck in those kind of things when you have that kind of outcome. But I mean, it was splendid. It was textbook and amazing. They've tried to resimulate that emergency procedure that he executed. They tried to simulate it in the in the simulators and found it was very difficult to perform. And the guy was, yeah, I mean, he was incredible. And I mean, I'm sure that people pray for that man every day because he was a wonderful, wonderful pilot. Everybody wishes that they had a Chesley Sullenberger as their captain. That's for sure.
Now, you mentioned in the book at one point you were struck by ball lightning.
Yeah,
there are lightning strikes, as noted here. Birds, you can hit a flock of birds. I mean, does this happen? I mean, I don't know if they would even alert you. Actually, that's a good question for you. Would they alert you if you were flying and you ran through a flock of birds? I mean, first off, given the size of the airplane and the size of the birds, if they were, let's say, 3-pound birds or whatever, would anyone on the flight even notice? Would this be a matter of concern at that size? How often does this happen?
It does happen from time to time, and it usually happens on takeoff. You know, one particular airport that's very bad for that is Kennedy Airport. They have a real bad bird problem, certainly most people aren't aware of it, but they have a simulated shotgun shells going off all the time out in the areas of the departure runway to try to scare the birds away. So it does happen. As a captain, I think I kind of think that the question that you're asking is, you know, would you notify the passengers? And I think you would if for example you hit some birds, some of the birds got ingested in the engine, and the engine, let's say, stalled. When I say stalled, I'm talking about a compressor stall. If you heard a loud bang, I'm sure you would tell the passengers, "Oh, we hit some birds, and we had a compressor stall, but the engine parameters look good, and we're going to continue, or we're going to continue and monitor, or we're going to return and inspect the engine." So I think that it would depend on the severity of the bird strike as to whether you would inform the passengers or not. You wouldn't want to get passengers unduly worried if it wasn't necessary to return or alter the flight.
Now, aside from 9/11, would DB Cooper be the most famous hijacking in airline history?
Outside of 9/11, I would say probably there were a couple of others. There was one, in fact, we had one with Capital, where a passenger succeeded in hijacking the airplane to Cuba by putting a knife to the throat of a flight attendant in the back of the airplane, and then the captain was contacted, and he decided to go along with the hijacker's demands because it was a safe course of action, and it was likely that he was going to be able to save the flight attendant in that way. I mean, he was worried about the flight attendant's life, and what he was going to do was to fly the airplane to Cuba out of New York, and he did, and landed successfully. The Cuban authorities came on board the airplane. They didn't treat the hijacker very well in that particular case, and I don't really know if that hijacker ever got out of Cuba, but I know the story because a friend of mine was the captain on that flight, and David Dean, and I know the story sort of secondhand from David. But so that was certainly a fairly well-known hijacking. And I think there's been a couple of others. But, D.B. Cooper, it's always a mystery because people wonder what happened to him. You know, is he alive or did he die when he parachuted out of that 727?
Did you ever take a look at it? I mean, what do you think happened? Could a person have survived that jump?
I think he could have survived it, but one of the problems was that where he landed, it was a very remote area. I think, didn't he land in Oregon? I think he did.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a very remote area, and I think it was wintertime. It was reported that he didn't really have the proper clothing for survival in winter conditions. So I've read quite a few reports about it, and actually I've seen some summaries from the FAA and with some excerpts from the FBI, and I think it's pretty well believed that he perished. And they did find some fairly substantial amounts of that ransom money.
The money, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now I remember reading a book about him, and there was a stat in there which I cannot remember, but it was completely, I mean, to my mind, it was just ridiculous. It was before D.B. Cooper. It was the number of hijackings that took place during an average year, and it was ridiculous. It was like, I can't even remember the number, so I shouldn't even say anything, but it was very high, like one a week or one every other week or two a week or some number that just completely blew my mind. Was it really that crazy prior to the D.B. Cooper hijacking? And was D.B. Cooper when everything sort of changed as far as security?
You know, I think that was one of the incidents that helped change things dramatically. But, you know, as a pilot, it was not something that you really gave a lot of thought to, because even though, I mean, I'm sure your stats are accurate, it still wasn't a number that any pilot would say, gosh, I better really watch out because this could be the flight. You know, I don't think pilots really gave it that much thought, because it just didn't seem to happen that often. But yeah, D.B. Cooper was a particularly striking experience, and I think that really helped. You know, I remember flying out of Kennedy Airport and noticing that the baggage handlers at Kennedy, this was back in, let's see, the 70s and late 70s, baggage handlers would stick a matchbook in the entrance door to the baggage area, which really meant that almost anybody could open that door and and get in and do some mischief. In fact, if you remember, out of Kennedy there was some Puerto Rican extremist group that wound up planting a bomb on an airplane, and the airplane blew up. I don't know if you recall that one, but that was a particularly bad one. But I always complain. I mean, I was one of the guys that would contact the FAA continually and say, gee, somebody's been one of the baggage handlers, undoubtedly, because he didn't want to get his keys out of his pocket while he was pushing his baggage cart, you know, was propping the door open to the baggage area. And it took quite a while before that was ever addressed. But now, I mean, the whole situation has, you know, since 9/11, has been so thoroughly addressed that, I think from the point of view of access, unauthorized access to baggage and unauthorized access to the ramp, I think that's really been addressed quite well. Now, whether it can really prevent another terrible disaster, I mean, it's anybody's guess. I think, unfortunately, where there's a will, there's a way, and some devious mind, and some of these people, you know, are smart people that do this kind of crazy stuff. I mean, they're not necessarily completely stupid, as you might want to think. The only thing is, they're using their intelligence, you know, for obviously terrible reasons, or terrible putting the intelligence to terrible use. And unfortunately, you know, they're able to sometimes find new ways to cause damage and mischief.
I was born in the mid-70s, so my memory of that period is non-existent. But there's a scene in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas where Dr. Gonzo's dropped off at the airport, and he just literally runs across the tarmac and jumps on the airplane.
Yeah.
Was this how crazy it was during that period? I mean, for younger listeners, I mean, tell them a little bit about the complete lack of airport security during that period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was certainly in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, you could walk onto the tarmac of any busy airport. I mean, Los Angeles was a great example. You know, in the 70s, I mean, little terminal that they had, you could just walk onto the tarmac. And you know, you could probably get quite far across the towards the runway before somebody would come along in a car and stop you and say, hey, what's going on? Where's your security badge? But that has really changed. And in that respect, it's changed for the better.
Now, there are some things. I just want to talk about this very quickly, since I know everyone wants to talk about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. But since I do a lot of flying, I gotta get my own personal... I got to get my own things off my chest here. This right. I've noticed lately, I flew on Delta, and they did not make me power down my iPad. As long as it was on airplane mode, I no longer had to power that thing down.
Yeah.
Used to always drive me crazy that you have to, even if it's on airplane mode, they made you turn it off. And now they're not doing it so much anymore. Do you have, there are always these things. I've asked pilots about this before, like, you know, I can't recline my seat very much, maybe mm-hmm. like 2 inches.
Yeah.
But that 2 inches matters to the, you know, they're telling you move that. And I understand, like, not having the, you know, the, what you put your food on, what's that thing in the back of your seat
tray table.
I can understand the tray table being up because you don't want to go into that.
No.
But some of these things kind of seem like, is that 2 inches on the seat really that important? Is the cell phone being off on airplane mode, is that important? Well, I guess the question to you is, you know, nowadays, what is important and what is unimportant in these rules?
All right. Well, it's a good question. You know, as far as the 2 inches is concerned about reclining your seat 2 inches, I think there's a couple of ways you could look at that. I mean, I can understand your point of view and you say, what does 2 inches, you know, mean to you? But, I mean, in all fairness, and you might not like my answer, remember you're taking 2 inches away from the passenger, 2 inches of space away from the passenger behind you.
Sure.
So that in the event of an unexpected accident or incident, you know, that seat is going to be 2 inches closer to his head. So I don't know whether that's really the reason for that, you know, for making sure the seat is vertical. But I know if I was behind that seat, I would rather have that additional 2 inches of space between me and the, you know, and what I'm going to, you know, hit in front of me. And of course, if you're a really big guy, that 2 inches probably, you know, is a godsend. And if you're a smaller person, the 2 inches may not mean quite as much. But so anyway, that's that. I don't know. As far as the operating electronics, and in particular cell phones that transmit energy, you know, being an electrical engineer, you know, as far as my education, I can say that the thought is that if you transmit while a pilot is, let's say, using an ILS receiver, making a critical approach, ILS approach in poor weather, you don't want to take the chance that any signals emitted from the cabin by a cell phone could interfere with the, you know, with the ILS receiver. And I gather, I mean, I've read with interest, I've read that there has been some instances in some airplanes where they've been able to show that transmitting with a cell phone was able to deflect the needle on an ILS receiver. And that was really allegedly the reason why they didn't permit it. But now I've read since that time, and that was a number of years ago, since that time they say that the shielding, the electrical shielding on the coax cables and on the other electrical cables in the airplane and from the antenna, which is oftentimes right on top of the passenger cabin, the receiving antennas, or below the cabin. So they say the shielding now is so good that they've tested, and they can't really duplicate a situation where someone talking on a cell phone has, in fact, interfered in any way with the navigation equipment on the airplane. So it looks to me like, from a technical perspective, the tendency or the what I'm kind of reading between the lines is that some airlines are getting ready to allow cell phone usage during flight. The other side of it is, can you imagine if you're flying on a 16-hour flight to Bangkok or to New Zealand or Australia, and your seatmate or someone in front of you or in back of you is talking nonstop the whole time?
Drive you nuts.
It would drive you crazy. So if it was up to me personally, I would prefer that there wasn't cell phone usage during flight, but, you know, I'm sure they're not going to ask me.
I'm not a fan of the idea of everybody talking on their cell phones during the flight. But I think that the ability to use them to read, I don't even really have a problem with airplane mode.
Yeah.
I just remember when I would have it on airplane mode and they would still say, you cannot look at that.
Like that.
Yeah. Drove me nuts.
It seems like they're easing off on those kind of restrictions. I mean, they're getting a little more flexible. And that's a good thing, I think.
All right. Let's talk about Flight 370. It is, as of this moment, not been found. And I'm talking, nobody has any idea who, what, when, where, why.
Right.
What is your theory on what happened?
Okay. Well, you know, it's a interesting question, and it's something I've pondered. I've always been interested in accident investigation, and I've always, you know, read a lot of things about accidents and incidents just to try to use it to improve the safety of my flights. So I kind of looked at this very carefully, and what I see is that obviously, number one, they haven't found the flight recorder and the voice recorder. You know, the flight recorder gives all the parameters of the positions of the flight controls, the parameters of the engines, what kind of power they're putting out, what kind of control inputs have been applied, G-forces, heading, altitude, and so forth. So finding the flight recorder would be of tremendous value in analyzing what happened. The voice recorder, obviously everybody knows what that is. It's recordings of the last 2 hours of conversation in the cockpit. And that could certainly, shed some light on what happened. So, but failing to find these two black boxes, which happen to be orange, failing to find these, it's unfortunately left to pure speculation. And that's all we have to go on at this particular point. Now, by the way, if they found parts of the airplane, large, let's say, portions of the metal exterior of the airplane or the cabin, they can tell a lot as to whether or not there was an explosion, because of the fragments on the aluminum skin and how they impinged on the skin. If there was, God forbid, a rocket shot at the airplane, they would, you know, there's a possibility if they found the right piece of metal, they could see that that happened. They can tell if there's fire, was fire. They could tell if there was smoke and some other things and heat and so forth. So finding parts of the airplane would be very helpful, as well as even parts of the seats and also the condition of the passengers if they found that. Would help you to make a determination what happened. But barring all of that, my opinion...
Actually, before we go into your opinion, I do a couple of questions based on what you said.
Yeah.
Okay, so first off, why are they called black boxes if they're orange?
I think anything on an airplane, you know, that has a lot of electronics inside, it's really frequently called or referred to as a black box. It's a good question. I can't really give you a 100% definite answer as to what why they call the box which is painted orange the black box, but it isn't. It's actually an orange box.
Okay.
And it's orange for the ability to locate it, you know.
Sure, sure. Black would be difficult in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the voice recorder records the 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been talk, we'll talk more about your theory, but there is a thought that the plane flew on for many, many hours.
Right.
After,
right.
And so let's just say that there had been some sort of, something happened and for some reason everyone in the entire aircraft was killed. And the plane just continued to fly on. If they find that voice recording, it's only recorded the last 2 hours. It could be silence.
Absolutely.
So has there ever been any talk of extending extending that period to maybe like 9 hours or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that. And personally, I see the value of recording for a longer period, like you say, 9 hours, which would probably encompass most of almost every flight, and you know, maybe for some overseas specific flights to, you know, to Asia, you know, to the to Asia, maybe you'd need a longer recording. But
sure,
I think it'd be a good idea. I really do. You know, I think that would be an excellent idea to extend the recording. Yes, it would. It would mean a little larger box and it may be a little bit more cost, but I mean, when you consider what it costs to do this
whole investigation,
that they're doing, and yeah, and you know, you don't want it to go through all of this and then come up with a, you know, with the cockpit voice recorder that's blank. And if we perhaps heard the very beginning of the flight, it would shed light onto what happened. So I think it's important to do that. I think you have a good idea there.
And finally, we've been hearing about how the black box will ping or whatever for X number of days, and then the battery dies.
Right.
How long is the data still extractable? I mean, if we found it in 6 months,
absolutely extractable.
Okay,
there's no question that it could be read. The only thing that could...
What about the pressure at the bottom of the ocean?
No, they are made. For very, very deep depths, I would say for miles deep, for all kinds of pressure, that wouldn't be an issue. The only issue could be if they were damaged during an accident and where the airplane wound up in the water, and then salt water got in and then started to do damage.
Sure,
you know, that would keep it from being read. But no, I think they're readable for years.
Mm-hmm. All right, your theory.
Well, I'm concerned about what I read about the captain, and that is that apparently, and I read this in numerous articles, that his wife had left him the day before the flight. That's number one. And they were having some marital difficulties for some time, but she decided to leave the day before the flight. That's number one. So this would reflect on his status, his mental status. I mean, because you know, if you're a pilot and your wife leaves the day before her flight, I think it would be of grave concern to you, and I think it'd be on your mind. That's number one. Number two, his daughter originally was reported to say that she thought her dad was acting very strange in the week before the flight. Another thing, I've read that two of the captain's friends had stated that he was in no condition to fly. They had made statements like that. Apparently, the captain,
as in like his mental state,
mental,
or he'd been drinking.
Yeah, mental state.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there was a report that he had a lady friend, and the lady friend was very unhappy with him. So that's another bit of pressure. And then the final things that I've read in several reports was that he had a friend who was a politician who was sort of an opposition politician to the current administration in Malaysia, who was on trial, and actually the captain of this MH370 attended the trial in the morning before the flight. And he was quite upset about what was going on with his friend. And his friend was convicted and sentenced to a substantial jail sentence. So, and reportedly, he was quite upset about that. So if you put all of these issues together, so to speak, it would kind of paint a picture of somebody, a captain, who has a lot on his mind and might very well affect his performance, or for that matter, could possibly affect the course of the flight. He might have decided that, and I'm just purely speculating this, maybe he decided that he had enough, and he was going to do something, unseemly or untoward, perhaps this may be have led him to do something that resulted in the termination of the flight, and other than an airport. So, again, that's pure speculation, and it's based on what I read, just numerous articles that I've read. And I hope it's not the case because, you know, when this kind of thing happens, it certainly reflects badly on the profession. And by the same token, I mean, everybody is looking for an answer. And, you know, it's something that that apparently has been reported, and I would definitely give it some weight. It's sort of a leads one to believe that this may be the issue here. So
now one thing about it that I find strange, and as a pilot, you can perhaps, or maybe not, maybe no one can explain this, but uh-huh. I've often thought that maybe it was suicide mission is probably wrong, but maybe he decided, yeah, okay, well, we're all going down.
Right.
And you know, I would think that once you've made this decision, mm-hmm, just go down. But the what happened to the plane,
yeah,
if it diverted course and then really was flying on for 7 hours or whatever the number is, this is a very strange suicide mission. I'm not sure exactly what, I don't know if maybe his decision was, well, you know, I don't want to face the shame of having done this suicide, but I want to commit suicide, so I'm just going to take this plane with it and I'll find it again.
Right.
There's a lot of, well, let's just start with that. I mean, what do you make of just this diversion and the long flight?
Yeah, well, I think your points are very well taken. The, you know, if a person didn't care what people thought of them, if a pilot didn't care, then yeah, you're right. Why, you know, prolong the thing? Why not just, you know, just go down right there and be done with it? But then on the other hand, if, you know, you were concerned with what your family and friends and other people would think, that's number one. Number two, I don't know, maybe there's insurance involved, and maybe, you know, some types of insurance may not pay off in a suicide type of a mission. So you decide, you know what, I really want my heirs to get the insurance payments, you know, maybe from my company. So therefore, I'm going to pick the deepest part of the ocean I can fly to, and do this in such a way that it's likely it'll never be determined that it was suicide. Now, there's one other thing that I would point out that I've read and was reported fairly widely, is that it was discovered that the airplane had actually climbed above its service ceiling to 45,000 feet. Now, autopilots don't do that. Even, well, for one thing, if the engines failed or ran out of fuel, which at that point, if it did, it wouldn't have climbed, it would have gone down. If the pilots became incapacitated, the autopilot wouldn't suddenly just start climbing. It doesn't do that. So it had to have been set up to climb. Now, why it would have done that, some speculation would be, well, if the person who hijacked the airplane or took control of the airplane, if they climbed to 45,000 feet and then depressurized the airplane, and himself, that person went on oxygen. You know, pilots have oxygen masks right next to them, and they're quick donning masks. They can put it on in seconds. You have to do that in the simulator every 6 months to demonstrate a rapid decompression. So, you know, you're used to putting on an oxygen mask. You can put it on in a second, and then you could depressurize the airplane, and within, at 45,000 feet, within about 20 seconds, all the passengers would be incapacitated. I mean, they'd be unconscious, and they would probably die if, you know, they didn't get oxygen on. And then you could then gradually descend, and you wouldn't have to worry about the passengers using their cell phones and reporting, hey, something's going on, we're not flying towards China, we're going somewhere else, and we don't understand what's happening. And then, of course, you know, authorities would be alerted and so forth, assuming they were close enough to a cell station to make that call. So you instantly would resolve the problem of the passengers either trying to break into the cockpit or making cell phone calls by basically asphyxiating them, by lack of oxygen. So yeah, that, you know, that that kind of gives me the idea that, yeah, there was some intent there to, you know, to incapacitate the, you know, the passengers.
Yeah, I mean, based on, it makes complete sense to if you were going to do this and want to incapacitate the passengers, that would make sense to do that. The obvious other question is, what about this co-pilot?
Right.
Do you send him into the cabin before you? Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all you'd have to do is say, "Hey, listen, I felt a vibration. Go back to the cabin and look out at the left engine and see if anything's going on." He leaves the cockpit, and you lock the door, and he'll never get back in because the doors are pretty much impregnable to breaking into the cockpit. So you've gotten rid of the co-pilot in that particular case. I mean, assuming if that's what happened.
Sure.
But you could do it. Yeah, it could be done.
Now,
and you know, that brings up one last thing I'd like to mention.
Sure.
And that is, I have kind of a thing about two-man crews as opposed to three-man crews. I did my flying of jumbo jets when they had three-man cockpits. They had a flight engineer. And I always thought that was a great idea, to have a three-man crew, but the airlines didn't think it was such a great idea because they could cut the crew down to two men and save, I don't know what it would be, $100,000 to $300,000 a year for that extra crew member, you know, the training costs and all the salary expenses and so forth. But the thing is, by having that extra crew member, you have, number one, another pair of eyes. So instead of having four eyes, essentially, you have six eyes, you know, looking at instrumentation on landings and takeoffs, looking for other aircraft, keeping an eye out, and so forth. And then in the event that something went on in terms of an engine malfunction or in case of another type of mechanical malfunction, the engineer, you know, was able to handle that while the pilots can concentrate on their flying duties. So I always thought it was a bad idea that the airlines went to a two-man crew. Now, in this particular case, think about what we were talking about. Had there been a three-man crew, and if the speculation that one of the pilots is responsible for this disaster, you could have sent the co-pilot out, but then you'd have the engineer to deal with the remaining pilot who's trying to do something untoward towards the flight. So I think that would have resolved. It probably would not have happened had there been a three-man crew. I'm sure that I'm not confident that we'll ever change back to a three-man crew. But I think it's a big safety addition to have that third man in the cockpit. We've gotten away from it, and I think there's been a few accidents that could be attributed to not having a three-man crew anymore.
I know we've gone a long time here, but I got a couple more questions if you can stick around.
Yeah.
Now let's go by the scenario that what you have speculated, many people actually, I'm sure, have speculated this, that the cabin was depressurized and that was the end of everybody in the cabin.
Right.
Now, when, let's say that he set it to go up to 45,000 feet and depressurized the cabin, would the oxygen masks not automatically drop from the ceiling, or can that be prevented as well?
That could be deactivated. You know, there are.
This seems like a bad idea to allow that to be deactivated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the only positive reason for that might be that let's say the masks were activating and dropping out because of some little malfunction during the flight, and you're already. Let's say if you're going on an oceanic type of a voyage, you're past the point of no return, so you want to put all the oxygen mask back and you don't want it to drop out again. So if that was happening, so you might pull the circuit breaker. I'm not sure that would be a good idea, but I mean, that would be one scenario where you might have a need for that, or where maybe that circuit is causing a fire or smoke, so you want to, and you've isolated it to that oxygen mask circuit. So you pull the circuit breaker, but yes, it could be deactivated, and that's what probably it's probably what they could have done. But here's another thing: the the oxygen available, the supplemental oxygen, of, that's what it's called, that's available to the passengers is for a very limited time. And for every airplane, it's a little bit different. It depends on the amount of passengers and the capacity of the oxygen system. But it may only have been 4 or 5 minutes or maybe 6 minutes of oxygen. And you say, well, why so little? Well, because if you have a cabin a rapid decompression, the pilot's duty during that time is to pull the power back to extend the speed brakes and to descend as quickly as possible to 10,000 feet. I mean, that's the emergency procedure. And so therefore, you would only be at the high altitude, the passengers would only be at the high altitude without oxygen for just a few minutes. It doesn't take but probably 4 or 5 minutes to get down from 35 or 37,000 feet. But if this hijacker or this person commandeering the airplane and doing this horrible thing, if he decided to do this, he could have gone up to 45,000 feet. The oxygen mass and he could have depressurized the cabin. The oxygen mass would have deployed. The passengers would have put on the oxygen mask, but it wouldn't have helped after 4 or 5 minutes because they would have run out of the supplemental oxygen and they would have become unconscious. I mean, that's a horrible thing.
Sure.
That's what could have happened.
Now, when we look at, okay, so as you noted, a plane on autopilot is not going to climb to 45,000 feet.
No, not on its own. Not on its own at all. You'd have to intentionally do that.
And there were some things that happened.
Yeah.
That were clearly, I mean, I don't know all of the details if they were attempting to avoid radar or what was being done, but clearly something was happening. Somebody was controlling this plane. We do know that.
That's how it appears, yeah.
Now, have you, right. I don't know the timeline, but do we know if this intelligent control of the plane continued after they descended from 45,000 feet? Meaning, is it possible that as part of his deal, it was, all right, I'm going to set a course for the middle of the Indian Ocean or wherever, and I'm going to climb to 45,000 feet, and we're all going to go together. I'm not going to put my mask on either. And once everybody in this airline is out, this plane is just going to continue on until it runs out of fuel.
Yeah. So the question is that possible that they did that?
I mean, do we know if that's possible based on how the plane was behaving after it descended from 45,000 feet?
You know, and I don't know that. I bet that the authorities know that. I didn't see that a timeline and that showed a plot of the direction of the airplane in relation to its altitude. I've read in separate reports that it had climbed to 45,000 feet. Then I learned, then I read later that after that it had descended all the way down to 5,000 feet and then flew for a while at 5,000 feet. So that's answering your question only slightly. So I didn't read where it showed direction and position relative to altitude, but that would be very important. Your question is a great question, and the authorities have that answer, I would think, but I have not read it. Yeah, and that would tell us a lot.
And two final questions here, and then we'll talk about your book and get some plugs in.
Okay.
Are you surprised that here we are in 2014 and some of the, I mean, you read about NSA spying and such, and meanwhile, this airplane disappears and just complete bafflement. Nobody has any idea what's going on, where it's at, what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, is this surprising to you, or is it just
is.
Because of where it occurred and... I mean, I guess the best question to you is, could something like this happen in like a transatlantic flight? Does this surprise you that this happened?
It does. You know, with satellites mapping the Earth, I would think that somewhere in some archive there are tapes, CDs that have recorded all of these flights, and they could pick up this flight and that they could see the path that it flew. That's what I would think. And now, whether that in fact is true or not, I guess remains to be seen. The other thing, of course, that we do know, if you look at Google Maps, you know that certain areas that are map with Google have very high resolution, and those are areas around high density population areas, and then areas of lesser population. I mean, you could then make that equivalent to less areas of less importance. The resolution on the photographs are much less. So maybe out in the Indian Ocean, the resolution is so poor that they would have difficulty, you know, following the airplane. Having said that, I still would kind of think that somewhere there would be some satellite mapping that could show this airplane. I mean, the way that they have made the determination is very clever. You know, they use some engineers from the Rolls-Royce company, which is the ACARS, you know, the aircraft reporting, automatic reporting system for the engines, was set up so that it could send information from the engines back to Rolls-Royce. Now, what I've read is that Malaysian Airlines didn't pay for the service, so all Rolls-Royce had were these hourly pings from the transponder, from the ACAR. So what they did was the engineers looked at the Doppler effect of these signals, which were sent to the Inmarsat, the marine satellite that was used to communicate between the satellite and the airplane. Well, they did these Doppler effect studies, and they could make a approximate determination of the position of the airplane based on the Doppler effect, which is not all that accurate to do that. But it was clever what they did, and it would seem like it was helpful because, as you know, they did get four pings from the flight and or voice recorders in that area where the Rolls-Royce engineers thought the airplane probably was. So, I mean, it kind of backs up what the Rolls-Royce scientists and engineers mathematically calculated. And that's an amazing thing. I mean, that's a tribute to science to have been able to do that. You know?
I don't know if CNN is still doing 24/7 coverage. Yeah. I know they were for like a month and a half. But I always kind of thought that, you know, anytime there's an airline tragedy, it's, you know, people are going to be very, very interested. But
oh, yeah.
I think that it was such a big story because it was very sobering for people to realize that, my God, in 2014, an airliner could just vanish.
Yeah.
And nobody could have any idea what happened or where it's at or anything. Right. And I think that that's why people are so fascinated by the story. I guess my last question involving this and really airline safety in general is based on what happened and things that occurred. Is there anything that you really are passionate about that you think that should be fixed or overhauled in the aviation industry today?
Hmm. Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. One of them I mentioned, Brian, and that is, and I know this is pie in the sky, it probably won't happen. I do really believe that flying would be safer to have three men in the cockpit. And maybe for some unrelated reason they'll do it. Maybe because they'll say, well, we've got to get a third man in to be in training all the time so that when the captain retires, we're going to have enough people there. Maybe they'll do it for that reason. But I really think the reason to have the third man crew would be for safety. So that was kind of one thing. The other thing is, I would like to see more security on baggage. That's for sure. I'd like to see both pilots armed on every airplane. I think that would be a good thing. And the other thing, the last thing I would mention that I think would be a good thing, is stricter duty time regulations where the pilots, in some cases where there's two pilot crews, the pilots can be on duty 12 hours, and I think that's way too long, especially when you consider that a lot of those pilots who do international flights have been going back and forth across time zones. And even though you might think, well, 12 hours, that's not too bad. I work 8 hours every day. What's 12-hour day? He's only doing it four times a month.
You don't want to be tired as a pilot.
No. And that's right. And there's been more than enough incidents where both pilots were asleep, overflew, you know, the one in Chicago where they overflew the destination. Finally, one of them woke up hearing the radio calls, and I guess ATC, air traffic control, asked them, "Where are you going?" And they said, "Chicago." And the guy said, "Well, you passed it 200 miles ago." Of course, those pilots, I think they're both trying to get their jobs back, understandably, that happened. But, when you cross so many time zones, you know, I think they have to consider that. There's been lots of studies from NASA to indicate that pilots are flying really tired. And I would really like to see the duty time reduced, not because I think pilots should work less, but I think pilots should be more alert and awake. And, so those are my...
You know, it's interesting. I read a book. I can't remember the name of the book, but it was talking about airline crashes. Mm-hmm. And they had done this big study, and they found that, like, you know, the vast majority of them, I guess this should not be a surprise, but they're red eyes. They're they're overnight flights because guys get tired.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, come 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, if you haven't slept all night, I mean, you're having a heck of a time. You're really struggling to keep alert. And that's not a good thing. That really is not a good thing.
Your book, Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an Airline Pilot's Story, PJ Spivak. It's up on Amazon.com. There's a Kindle edition and a paperback edition. And it's a great book. It's
thank you.
I don't know a lot about flying. Mm-hmm. But your book is very good because it's detailed, but it's not so detailed that I've absolutely no idea what you're talking about. That makes sense. It's a very good balance. And one of the things that I liked, we didn't even talk about some of the other stuff that you talk about in the book, including some close up visits with sharks, mm-hmm. not on airplanes, mind you, but elsewhere. There are a lot of great stories in there, but I also really liked at the very end of the book, mm-hmm. you've got a list of suggestions for anybody that wants to become an airline pilot. And I liked it because I read it and it was kind of like, whether you want to be an airline pilot or you want to bag groceries or whatever you want to do in your life, read this advice, because this is great advice for just getting a job and keeping a job anywhere. It's really great.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for noticing that. I've said to many folks, I said, you know, these 3 or 4 pages in this chapter are probably the most important. They may not be the most entertaining, but they're the most important 3 pages in the book. And, you know, essentially, it would apply exactly as you say to anybody, whether they wanted to become an airline pilot or whether they wanted to become an executive or whether they wanted to, you know, just to work for any good company. And it's basically, you know, develop your demeanor, that's your outward manner and appearance. Be ethical with people. Treat people exactly like you want to be treated. Be responsible. Accept responsibility. And boy, that, you know, that would be a great thing for our political leaders of both parties to think about. Take responsibility, you know, for the things you do or don't do well. Be persistent, you know, and just there are always going to be setbacks in your life. In anybody's life, you're going to have setbacks, and you just have to look at them as teachable moments and never to give up, and just learn from those teachable moments, and you will succeed. If you keep plugging away, you will succeed. The other thing, kind of a little bit more bent towards the cockpit, is don't be judgmental to your fellow crew members, but that could go, you know, for the workplace.
Sure.
If you're working in a small, close environment, try not to be judgmental of other people. And I'll tell you, you know, Brian, one thing I learned a long time ago as a longtime captain, that sometimes I made quick judgments of people, my co-pilots, and I thought, oh, that guy is not a friendly guy, or that guy is a jerk, or this or that. I made a quick judgment. And, you know, by just holding my tongue and just trying not to show that judgment that I made, I realized as I gave that person a chance that actually he was a darn nice person, or a darn good person. So what I'm saying is, don't be quick to judge people. In fact, don't. I think be non-judgmental, and I think that will help you a lot. So, and be patient. You know, be patient with yourself. Be patient, you know, with your career, because if you're patient, you might be surprised. Just being a little more patient, you know, looking at things in a positive light. The thing, you know, your glasses is really half full rather than half empty, and things aren't really going good. But be patient and just look at it the other way and say, well, it's just going to take some more time. And I will almost guarantee everybody that, and I don't mean to preach about this, by the way, but it's helped me. It's really helped me to be successful. I would advise anybody to think about those three pages and to read it and see whether it might apply in their lives.
Very good advice right there at the end of the book. Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an airline pilot story. 4.5 stars out of 5 on Amazon with 45 reviews. So everybody loves this book. And if you have any interest in anything we're talking about here today, I do recommend that. So PJ, is it Spivak or Spivak?
Spivak.
Okay.
Yep.
I want to make sure I got it right before I wrapped up here. But I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I was really looking forward to this. I really liked the book, and I love this interview. So thanks so much, and best of luck with everything you do.
Thank you, Brian. I'm a big fan of yours, and thanks a lot for having me.
And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in just a moment. After Dark Radio, Brian Alvarez here, Dark Matter Radio Network. We're back here on the show, everybody. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio Show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Hope you guys loved that one. I sure did. That was PJ Spivak, the author of Dangerous Lessons and Guardian Angels, an airline pilot's story. It's available at Amazon.com. And in fact, if you're up right now, you can check out my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. I have included a link to the book if you want to head up there and check that out. You can also check out my Twitter on the website, afterdarkradioshow.com. You can check it out. And thanks so much to PJ for the show. Really had a good time. Phones have been ringing for a long time. Couldn't take any calls during the program. But let's see what people have on their mind. 855-478-4478. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. This is Josh from Kansas City. How are you doing tonight?
What's up, Josh?
Actually, I was kind of hoping to be able to talk to PJ about it too, but since we're talking about Flight 370, I was curious of what your opinions are on TWA Flight 800.
You know, I was thinking of asking him about Flight 800, but we actually originally were scheduled to not go as long as we did, but I had so many questions that I didn't get a chance to ask about it. I don't know. I've always wondered about Flight 800. What happened to it? I've read a lot about it. I don't put it out of the realm of possibility that it was an act of terrorism. But I don't know. I haven't followed it close enough to really form an opinion one way or the other. But I don't rule it out. It's very strange.
Well, I can tell you this, my father worked for TWA, and I was about to drop the S-bomb. I can tell you this, he had just gotten home from having to work in San Francisco when the plane went down, and no sooner he was in bed for about 5 minutes, and he was already on a plane to New York and spent the better part of that summer out there, and he swears up and down that it was friendly fire from the Navy.
Friendly fire?
Yes, that it was friendly fire from a Navy ship, and a missile went through it.
Really?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, he spent, I guess it was half of July through August out there on the waters, and that's, there was no doubt in his mind that that's what it was. And I'm actually sitting here holding a book by a guy named James Sanders that, surprisingly enough, it's just one of those books he'd probably pick up at an airport for $4.99, something to read on a flight. But this guy, from what my dad tells me, it was called The Downing of TWA Flight 800 back in, I think it was produced in like 97, but pretty much says exactly what my dad was led to believe.
What's the name of the book?
The Downing of TWA Flight 800 by James Sanders.
James Sanders. All right, I'm going to pass that along to our producer, Garrett, and maybe we can get him on the show and talk about that.
Well, and anything else aside, too, I could probably get my dad. He'd be more than happy to talk to you guys, too, if you ever want to do an episode just about Flight 800.
Actually, I would. You want to email me and we'll set it up?
I will shoot you an email, Brian.
All right, sounds great. Well, thanks so much for the call.
No problem. You have a good one.
You too. Very interesting there. I was going to ask about Flight 800, but I just wanted to get into the Malaysian. People have been asking me about the Malaysian Airlines flight for, I guess, 6 weeks now. So I wanted to get into that, but maybe we'll have PJ on again at some point and ask him about that, but for sure we'll set up one of those and talk about it. Very interesting. So his father's claim is friendly fire. Friendly fire. I always thought that maybe it was the first attempt to, I guess not attempt, successful attempt, I guess would be, to take down an airliner with like a shoe bomb. One of the shoe bombs. So there you go. We will follow up on that. So there you go. If you want to give us a call, 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about the interview or anything else that is on your mind. We've got a lot of interesting articles to get into here, so we're going to jump into some of those. And again, you're welcome to call anytime with any of these, anything that is on your mind. All right, Kepler discovers the most Earth-like exoplanet. Very interesting here. Astronomers have located an Earth-sized world within the Goldilocks zone of a distant solar system. It is very, very similar to Earth. It is rocky, it is Earth-sized, and it is right inside the habitable zone. Not too hot, not too cold, not too close, not too far. Perfectly in the zone that might allow to support life very much like ours. We'll read more about that in just a moment. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Yeah, while we were trying to locate you.
Let's try you. You are on the air.
It's Ed in San Antonio.
What's up, Ed?
Hey, Brian, I was on Facebook, and our friend James McDaniel had posted some articles on his wall about supposedly some people using Google Maps that found the Loch Ness Monster. I was wondering if you talked about that or had seen it.
I have not talked about it, but I was actually looking at it right before we went on the air, this supposed new photo. I think it was Apple. It was the Apple satellite. It wasn't Google Maps. It was like Apple Maps.
Okay.
There's a picture that supposedly was taken in Loch Ness of what looks like something. I don't even know what. It's actually... I will find the article from the Daily Mail, and I'm going to send this out to everybody on Twitter. So stand by, everybody.
It looks like it could be like a big whale, but it does look.
Well, there should not be a giant whale in the lock, to the best of my knowledge. Hold on one second, Ed. DM Radio Net. All right, this is being tweeted out right now. You can check it out at Brian Alvarez or hashtag DM Radio Net. So head over there and check it out. It is, it's funny because there was another picture that I think was on Google Maps that looked very much like this, whatever the hell this is here, this supposed Loch Ness Monster. I actually thought it was the same photo, but apparently this is a different one. This is from Apple's satellite map. There are people who think that it's actually the wake of a boat, I don't know if I see that in this picture. I don't know what it would be. I think they're saying it was around 100 feet long. Actually, it's funny because this same article, this is from the Daily Mail. In the description, it says 50 feet, but in the article, it says 100 feet. So I don't know how they got it. I don't know how they figured the length and got it screwed up like that. But what do you think this is, Ed? Is this the wake of a boat?
I don't know. To me, the way it's shaped, it almost looks like a whippiece, like some kind of marine creature. And I doubt it's highly unlikely, but I mean, it would be so awesome if it actually, you know, that actually went, you know, one of these famous things actually turned out to be real, since apparently we can't find a Sasquatch.
Well, we have definitely been able to not been able to find a Sasquatch. I'm looking at this here, and I mean, there is a fin on each side. There is what appears to be a head. There's a body. It does appear to be very large, and I don't know what it is. So thanks for bringing that to my attention. And I guess if anybody has any ideas, the general belief among the skeptics that I have seen is that it is a boat has left a wake, but that's not what it looks like to me. Of course, I'm not really a guy that has, you know, seen a lot of boats from the air, but maybe I could Google about aerial. Let's just do some investigation here. Aerial view boat wake. See if we've got any pictures of that and see what it looks like. Well, there are some pictures here of boat wakes from the air, and they do look somewhat like what is seen in that photo, but I don't see anything that looks exactly like it. And it should be noted that in all of these pictures that I'm looking at of a boat wake, the one thing that you can really see besides the wake is the boat. And in the photo that I just tweeted out of the supposed Loch Ness Monster, you in fact cannot see the boat. So what is it? What do you think? Let me know on Twitter your thoughts. This person here says he was just going to tweet that to me. Well, you got out-scooped by Ed. Anyway, this rocky Earth-sized world, Kepler 186F, I believe is the name, Kepler 186F. Unlike most exoplanet discoveries that tend to be worlds either too hot, too cold, too close, too far, this newly identified world seems to be just right. And astronomers are hailing it as the single most promising candidate for an Earth-like planet elsewhere in the universe. Do you believe that in your lifetime we will find another planet just like ours that supports life? We have discovered a lot of planets over the past decade, and we're discovering more and more of them that appear to be in this Goldilocks zone. It would appear the day is coming, but we shall see. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian, this is Mason from Austin, Texas.
What's up, Mason?
I'm actually calling in about a traumatic shared experience that you and I had.
You were driving in Orlando for WrestleMania and just wanted to... No?
Close, dude. All right, so my thing is like live stuff. I go to shows. I've been to hundreds of concerts. I go to sporting events, stuff at the Superdome. I've been to Saints games, the Sugar Bowl. I was stuck in that tunnel for an hour and 20 minutes, Brian.
So you were there with me in the same tunnel?
I was in the section over from you. I actually met you at the Ring of Honor show, but I was in the section over from you. So yeah, I was stuck in that cluster for an hour and 20 minutes.
For those of you that...
I don't freak out. I'm chill. Like, nothing bothers me. And I was starting to freak out, dude. Like, was that not the most terrible crowd you've ever been in?
Yeah, for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, we were both at the Superdome for WrestleMania, and the Superdome is just never go there, ever. It's just a terrible building. And there was an incident where, for whatever reason, there was a bottleneck, and I was stuck, along with my wife, in the middle of... How many people do you think were in that bottleneck, squished in there? 500?
Hundreds. Hundreds. Easily hundreds.
Like 500 people, and it was unmoving. And of course, you know, everyone's carrying food. They're screaming to move. People are starting to get agitated. Like, you're so close to people that when someone tries to push through, like, nobody moves. We're just packed in there like sardines. And I thought there was going to be a, I thought a riot was going to break out. What did you have cops all over just doing nothing?
Started like the Dippin' Dots and the beer and the take your picture with CM Punk. People started tearing stuff down. Like, get out of our way, get out of our way. There's no room for commerce. Like, it was insane.
Yeah, did
the
you
cops
did,
didn't do anything?
Yeah, like, the cops just standing around doing nothing.
It was terrifying.
Horrible. Well, I'm glad you survived.
Yeah, I missed the pre-show too, but other than that, it was amazing. But yeah, never going to the Superdome ever
no,
again.
Ever. It's just a nightmare. All right, well, I want to thank you very much for the call. And yeah, as noted, Superdome, no buys. Don't go there. This guy here on Twitter says this photo looks like a giant whale shark, but I could also see how it could be a boat wake. I don't think there are giant whale sharks in Loch Ness. I don't think there are any. I don't think there are any whales of any sort in Loch Ness. I maybe I'm out of my mind. Probably could ask my wife. She'd know, but yeah. I don't think it's a giant whale shark. And if it is, it shouldn't be there. This person says it is clearly an alien submarine. I don't know about that either. This story here, also from unknown, unexplained-mysteries.com, which I screw up every time, always concerns me. A lab loses 2,000 vials of the deadly SARS virus. Really? Francis Pasteur Institute revealed the blunder after discovered that the vials had just gone missing. Authorities are now conducting a thorough investigation into the incident to determine the whereabouts of the vials, how they managed to just disappear. The SARS virus made global headlines back in 2003 when an outbreak in China resulted in more than 8,000 confirmed cases and 775 deaths across 37 countries. While the contents of these particular vials are not believed to be dangerous on their own due to the fact that they only contain fragments of the virus, the main concern is that if these vials can go missing so easily, what would happen if something far more deadly were to be misplaced? Well, at least that's good news. At least that's good news. It reminds us that each and every lab must have rigorous safety procedures, says this Dr. William Schaffner. People must be trained, and there has to be good supervision. You don't say. Now, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but do you believe this claim that the vials are not believed to be dangerous because they only contain fragments of the virus? Do you believe this? Or do you believe that maybe they misplaced 2,000 vials of the SARS virus, realized, oops, that's not good. We'll claim that it's no big deal. I think about that possibility. Again, I do not like the idea of losing 2,000 vials of the SARS virus. And finally, one more. Not a fan of this article from Salon.com. Your cell phone is killing you. But people do not want you to know about electromagnetic fields. It says the industry does not want to admit it, but the science is becoming clear. Sustained EMF exposure is dangerous. Now, if you read a lot about this, you'll hear everything. You'll hear it's very dangerous. It's not dangerous at all. It used to be dangerous. Not dangerous anymore. So what's the story here? Is this dangerous or not? It says you may not realize it, but you are participating in an unauthorized experiment, the largest biological experiment ever. Many of us are holding high-powered microwave transmitters in the form of cell phones directly against our heads on a daily basis. What health effects do these exposures have? Therein lies the experiment. The many potential negatives include many cancers and Alzheimer's disease, which can take decades to develop. There is a raging debate about the potential dangers of electromagnetic fields, which are being put off by your phone. The debate has two sides. On one side, there are those who urge the adoption of a precautionary approach to the public risk as we continue to investigate the health effects. And the group includes scientists who see many danger signs that call out strongly for precaution. On the other side are those who feel that we should wait for definitive proof of harm before taking any action. There have been cell phones around for a long time. How long are we talking here? If I use my cell phone until I'm 75 years old, am I guaranteed doom? What do you think we should do about this situation? Should we wait until there is definitive proof, or should we nip it in the bud, presuming that there is a great danger, when perhaps there is not? You can Google this and check it out for yourself. I will say that, at least me personally, and I think a lot of, I could be wrong, I could be completely out of my mind, but just from hanging out with my nephews and such, it's a lot less phone talking and a lot more texting. A lot of people aren't, I know I personally almost never talk on my cell phone. I talk on my cell phone very rarely, certainly not for an hour or more a day. I mean, I think I may have talked on my cell phone, probably talked on my cell phone for about maybe 15 minutes today, and the entire time it was through the Bluetooth connection in my car. So I never had the phone up to my head. How often do people nowadays actually hold their cell phone up to their head? I guess if you're making a call into this program, perhaps you're putting yourself at risk. But in general, a lot of people have Bluetooth. A lot of people do a lot of texting, emailing. I don't know. But I would like to see some good scientific studies about the risk or lack thereof of this cell phone exposure when holding it up to your head. Because there are a lot of claims that science has been done and it shows that these things are harmless. And of course, you will find the people that say, oh, there's been a lot of evidence that these things are harmful. So which is it? I guess we shall see. It is time to wrap it up, everybody. We've got a lot of stuff coming up over the next several weeks here on the After Dark Radio Show. Before we go, stick around, because we're not going to do an after show, but I do have one email that I want to read that is very, very interesting. It is about a listener who had a run-in with a troll. That's coming up in just a second. I'm going to wrap it up with that. But I do want to mention that we've got some very interesting shows coming up over the next couple of weeks. As noted, we had Larry Stone on last week. You've still got a couple of moments, if you're listening to this live, to go up to the website and check it out, because soon it will be gone and replaced with this show. This show was a lot of fun here tonight. Make sure you head up to Twitter and check out all of the information about our guest and his book, excellent book. That was, of course, tonight's show, Jay Spivak. And next week, we will be joined by Lawrence Krauss, who is a theoretical physicist and a cosmologist, who is a foundation professor of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. He has written a ton of books, including The Physics of Star Trek and A Universe from Nothing. Very excited for next week's show. That's going to be awesome. So he's going to be on the program next week. And in the next couple of weeks, we are going to have the man who ran the New Orleans Ghost Tour. He's going to be on the show. Probably, I think the week after next we're off. I'm not sure. But sometime soon, very early in May, we're going to have him on the program, and I've got some other great guests lined up as well. So make sure you keep checking us out, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can also head up to Facebook, check out our Facebook page, After Dark Radio Show on Facebook. My buddy Andrew is up there every single day with brand new articles. He does a tremendous job keeping the Facebook page updated. And of course, all of this is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And of course, support the Dark Matter Radio Network at darkmatterradio.net, and of course, artbell.com as well. which our illustrious webmaster Keith Rowland keeps updated regularly. Does a great job there. And we'll have a new After Dark After Show coming up in the next couple of weeks. Not tonight, but in the next couple of weeks. Now, before we go, I would like to read this email from Paul, who says that he sent me the email last week in regard to the haunted doll, you may recall. This is another scary tale from his life, which happened in late 2012. We will wrap up with this story. I was sitting in my living room, he writes, on my laptop, and out of the corner of my eye, there was a flash of blue light. I thought I was going totally mad or something had been reflected from outside. However, when I went over to inspect the area, I could feel static electricity. I asked other people to feel the same spot, and they all felt the same static electricity that I did. It remained for about a week after this event. The crazy blue light freaked me out, but it was nothing compared to what was to come. At approximately 3 a.m., I was still up on my computer working when I looked up and to the left. It was then that I saw it, only for a second, a weird troll-looking thing wearing a hood. It was about 3 to 4 feet tall and had an evil grin on its face. Naturally, I was totally shocked by this. However, for reasons unknown, I remained entirely calm. Normally, I freak out about little things, but I rubbed my eyes to make sure I wasn't crazy, and it was gone. Was I hallucinating? Did I see something I should not have seen? Was it from another dimension? At first, I thought I was hallucinating, but the static remained for about a week afterwards. Then thought I had gone mad, but I did not see anything else, thank God. So I ruled out the possibility of myself being a total loon. I asked around a couple of spirituality and conspiracy sites, but nobody had a good answer for what I saw. I never really believed in much of the unknown. I know that I had the toy incident, but I refused to accept it as anything paranormal until now. Well, I've gone from a total skeptic to a reluctant believer. I thought this type of thing only happened to people who lived out in the woods all by themselves. The type of people who claim they have been abducted by UFOs. People who the general public laugh at, not normal people living in apartment buildings in the center of large towns and cities. I've never told people in real life the full story for fear of ridicule. I've told them about the static, but not the troll. But I thought that might help other people. You are not all crazy. There is so much to this world that we do not know. So what did he see? Was it a glimpse into another dimension? Was it some sort of time shift, dimensional shift that left this feeling of static electricity where it occurred for a full week? I don't know. But with that, we are going to wrap it up. I want to thank y'all for listening here this week. Next week, we shall return with a brand new show. It's going to be a great time. Check out artbell.com, afterdarkradioshow.com, Facebook page, and everything else. And thanks again for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.
Algo me hace pensar que todo fue tal como debía ser. Los esqueletos caminan alrededor y yo avanzo con ellos, amor. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van, se hunden en el mar. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van en el alba. Eterna que me vio partir. creyendo perderlo todo. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van, se hunden en el mar. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van, en el alba.